Express Rebellion, what were Moshe and Korach arguing over? These two Medrashim, Tzitzis and Mezuzah. Korach was mocking Moshe by Tzitzis and by Mezuzah. About Tzitzis with the Beged, if it had Techeles Tzitzis, if the whole Beged was Techeles, versus one strand, whether or not he has to wear Tzitzis. If it the whole beged was tefillah. The question about the mezuzah, on whether or not the this is all medrashim, that the mezuzah basically is if you're supposed to put a mezuzah in someone in your house, and if you have many Torahs in the house, he asked Moshe if you have to put a mezuzah in the house. Rashi seems to depart from the psukim's regular pshat. So how do we understand Rashi in relation to the Psukim in Korach? This obviously is in connection to the rebellion of Korach towards Moshe.
So the way he explains it is as you begin with the rebellion of Korach, it has to be understood on different levels. It's to say, if you worry and simply on the level of the scriptural level, you get the impression of someone who was objecting to Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moshe Rabbeinu was amassing power for himself. That's what the basic thing is about. That he himself had assumed the leadership, and instead of being democratic, that's in a very general sense. The three things, Kichol Ha'edah Kulam Kedoshim, because the entire congregation is believing, Adu Atis Nasu Al Kahal Hashem. And why are you exalting yourself? Why are you assuming all this power over the congregation of God? So he's coming forth in the guise of someone who is very democratic. And in opposition to Moshe Rabbeinu, who he's saying that this is a distortion. And what you're doing is a distortion. And you're creating special elite, special aristocracy, which is connected essentially to yourself and to your brother, to your family. So it takes the form of a, specifically, what's the specific particular? It's one thing to have an idea in general. You can criticize something in general and abstract, but you can't get very far with that. You can't really rouse people. People may agree with you. People are always complaining about the system, whatever the system is. It's too much on this, it's too much taxes, or it's too much on the health, whatever the case may be. Hey, today's terms, he's too hawkish, too tough, so on and so forth, but generally that's not enough. It's got to focus on a particular. You have to have an incident or a specific cause that rallies people. Here it seems to be with regard to the kahuna. The fact that Aaron was designated to be the Kohen. And in fact, the entire test that Moshe established that God would intervene and God would demonstrate that this was, that's what he says, that this was below me leaving, Moshe says. This was not from me, but everything that I did according to God's dictate. That's the level of the, that's on the level of the Bechtav. However, Chazal have a deeper interpretation, that it wasn't so simple. That beneath the surface, there was a different element to the rebellion, which had to do with the way Moshe was administering the halacha. That's the famous story, as I'll say, that he gathered together 250 leaders of Sanhedrin, these great Talmidei Chachamim, and had them all dressed up in talitim that were completely made out of tchelet. The special blue dye, which basically, when you have the blue dye, it's obligatory to have one of the fringes, one of the tippets have to be dyed blue. But the rest of the talus is white. So they gather together basically to mock Moshe. And they ask the question that if the entire garment is made out of blue, so do the fringes still require the blue? So Moshe said, yes, because I love it. That is to say that the, halachically speaking, it doesn't make any difference. And there's other stories put down along the same lines, that a house which is filled with citrate tablet with sperm doesn't require a mezuzah. And Moshe said, yes. And in both cases, they didn't just disagree, but it was the intention was to mock. Mock me, to laugh. That doesn't make any sense. That if you have a mezuzah, which is just two parashiyot of the Torah, that's sufficient for the entire house. So a house which is the filled with the Torah should be fine, shouldn't need a mezuzah. And the same idea with the talis, that if one little fringe of the blue dye is sufficient to fulfill its purpose, because it's a concept that reminds a person of a cover of fine stone, so to speak. It's blue, and the blue reminds us the color of the ocean, and the ocean reminds them of the skies above, and that causes them to reflect on God. So there's a chain of connections between the blue and the concept of sky. So if that is sufficient, so you have a garment, the entire garment is made out of tefillah, so it shouldn't require the fringe. So Moshe Rabbeinu answered halachically. Everybody that's familiar with halacha knows that it doesn't work that simplistically. That the manner in which the time of the mitzvah, the reason of the mitzvah, is incorporated into the chesed of mitzvah, which is a whole different world. It's a whole realm of halacha, and the realm of halacha operates in accordance with its own principles, its own orbit, so to speak. And once you have that, you have to follow through. Everything has to be worked out in accordance with the specific halachic requirements. Halacha is a world of its own. It's a world of knowledge, the world of science, the world of ideas. And it is true that there is a connection between the world of halacha and the tamei and the tos, because you have two aspects to the mitzvah. You have the aspect of tamei mitzvah, the reason for the mitzvah. And this is an area which is very, very crucial. Very complicated, because there's very few people that can appreciate the true nature of the relationship between the tamei mitzvah and between the halachic structure of the mitzvah. Now, just pause it for a second. It's a very important point. The whole story over here. This is what differentiates. This is what we mean by bala bas. Okay? If you want to know what we mean when we use the term bala bas, this is a bala bas. It's interesting, because Karach seems to be speaking like a bala bas. The Rav writes an article about this, by the way. Do you have that book? I mean, it's not written by the Rav.
The Rav Schreiber?
Oh. Reflections of the Rebbe.
Yeah.
Again, it's nice, nicely written. The Rebbe used to use this expression, the logic of the businessman, so to speak. It's kind of practical. It's very, very crucial. I'm wondering if I have an example over here. I have some examples. Example. Here you have an of it.
I'm aware.
Rebbe?
Yeah, what?
All right. I'll tell you what to do. First in Hilchos Brachos, Perek Yud Yud Aleph.
Hilchos Brachos, we have that.
I'm sorry?
The Hilchos Brachos we have in the Gemara.
Oh, okay. You're fine. But you don't have the there.
What Perek?
11.
11.
Yeah. All right, so let me just continue with the thought, though. There's no question that there is a relationship between the mitzvah, that is to say, the halachic aspect of the mitzvah, and the tam of the mitzvah. Every mitzvah has a tam. And that's an important element. We can't ignore the time of the mitzvah and get completely focused on the halachic structure of the mitzvah. Because the halachic structure, the ma'aseh mitzvah, is a vehicle through which to achieve the time of the mitzvah. However, there's a lot of confusion with regard to the relationship between the two. And the attitude. There are some people, well, some people we know get completely focused on the halacha. They spend their entire time in life studying every different aspect of the halacha structure of the mitzvah. And to the extent where they may come, where, so to speak, the mitzvah, the maisa mitzvah, the action of the mitzvah becomes sort of an end in itself, if you can correct. Because the objective is to achieve the reason, the benefit, the purpose behind the mitzvah to the extent that we're capable of recognizing it. But then you have other people who are drawn to the time of the mitzvah, to the purpose. And they downplay the significance, the halachic significance. And they may have a view, there's different types of possibilities out there. I'm not going to analyze now all the different approaches that people might have. I'm just talking in general terms. That even people who recognize the halachic, but in terms of observing the halachic, they see it as a means to fulfill the purpose. And that the halachic should be malleable, so to speak. It should be flexible. And it should reflect the purpose. So that's a mistake. You can't approach it that way. That is to say, you can't say that this is the whole, this is the essence of the mitzvah. The essence is to achieve this purpose. So essentially, I recognize that the sukkah or the... are vehicles to remind us of certain things. So when it comes to fulfilling it, if there's a shaila, if there's a question, now it's to be done. So you can sort of use this approach. What's more in line with the purpose? That is not the correct approach. Because it's a failure to recognize that the halachic structure with all of the specifics and all the particulars, and also the determination of the result, as to how it should be done, does not have anything to do with that factor. It has to do, once you go into the halachic, it's true that the mitzvah, the structure of the mitzvah, if you ask which comes first conceptually, for example, which comes first, the time of mitzvah or the structure of the mitzvah? So from a logical standpoint, it would seem that the time. Because if the mitzvah, the activity of the mitzvah, is intended to achieve a certain purpose, that is to say that the sukkah, we're saying, the sukkah is to remember. So we should remember that the Jewish people, our ancestors, dwelled in huts, in booths. However you want to interpret it, whether it's physical booths or it's the clouds of glory that surrounds them, whatever the case may be. So clearly, that comes first. If you didn't have that factor, the time of it, is conceptually comes first. That's the purpose. If you didn't have that, you wouldn't have the mitzvah sukkah, you see? That's true. But that's the factor which is responsible, which is the catalyst for establishing the phenomenon of a sukkah. Once you establish the phenomenon of a sukkah, you're going into a different realm, the realm of the divinely ordained performances of mitzvah, and that is a realm of its own. That is to say, that's not in accordance with human lawmaking. It's not as though God gave it over to us and said, you must have a reminder, make some kind of a booth, some kind of structure, go out of the house, live in a booth, and do it in a manner that will remind people of this historical experience. That's not the case. The case is, it now becomes an arena of the performance of a mitzvah, and this is the subject of divine legislation. That is what's difficult for most people to understand unless they really immerse themselves seriously in the study of the halachic phenomena. That this becomes a realm of its own, and one has to learn it and study it. I wouldn't use the term science. It's an expression of the Chachmas Hashem, the wisdom of God, and it's a very abstract area. It operates differently. In fact, many people who study Talmud, that's the problem. That it's difficult, at least at first, to try and make your way because you're using ordinary human categories of law. And that's why you'll see at the very beginning, when you start to give reasons, they're not halachic reasons. They're the kind of reasons that lawyers would use. Even lawyers, you can see the difference, by the way, between halacha and and man-made law. It operates completely differently. A man-made law is much easier to follow because it's ordinary human logic and it's trying to achieve a certain purpose. That's why it's hard. They don't have clearly defined laws. It's very hard to define it in the abstract, and it's constantly changing. It's very malleable, so to speak. And that's an element in the rebellion of Korach. Korach wasn't negating the Torah Shabbat. He was not negating that. He wasn't negating the fact that God had also given us a system by which to incorporate the objective, the philosophy. But you see, this was the arena of his attack. And you can see why that could be the basis of a populist movement. Because the nation at large, the people in general, have this feeling that the mitzvot are important because of the purpose. But when you get down to the so-called, I'm just saying so-called, the nitty-gritty, the particulars, the details, that a lot of times people have a hard time dealing with. They don't have any patience. It sounds like you're scribbling because they don't understand the world of Allah. And that's really the arena that he attacks, according to Chazal. And Chazal says these kinds of questions. You see, a house which is filled with sperm. He wasn't denying the mezuzah. Someone who denies the mezuzah wouldn't ask this kind of a question. He doesn't know if it's important to have the mezuzah altogether. We should set up a household. He would say, set up a household according to the correct value. So what do I need a mezuzah when I walk in? He wasn't denying that. And the same thing with tzitzis. He wasn't denying chelas. He wasn't denying the need for tzitzis. But he accepted the concept of incorporating certain ideas into the beggar. He accepted that idea. But then he said, when you come down to an analysis, to a specific, it's going to come out to what would seem to be an absurdity. So here you have something which is even better, which is a garment that's completely dyed in chelas, in this new dye. So you're telling me that would require stitches as well? Doesn't make any sense. This is infinitely better than what the halachic requirement is. He wasn't denying the halachic requirement. He was acknowledging that if you don't have a white garment, you need stitches and you have the blue dye. He wasn't complaining about that. But he was taking it into a different arena where you could create what would seem to be an absurdity, and that's why they laughed. They laughed at Moshe Rabbeinu. He was trying to create an absurdity by exploiting this point that there'll be, if you just follow the halachic line down to its very end, where it seems to start to depart from its relationship to the Tom, you're going to create an absurdity. And that's where he was attacking Moshe Rabbeinu. You follow that point?
Yeah.
It's important. I just gave a general overview of what the attack was. Now, you do see that Korach wasn't stupid. He was very clever. That's what I'll say. He was a very clever guy. And he wasn't denying. That, to a certain extent, explains Michael's question. Answers it. That is to say, he wasn't denying that Moshe Rabbeinu... See, he's saying Moshe Rabbeinu was a guy crazy with the halachic over here. Something along those lines. That is, he wasn't denying that Moshe was here. He couldn't deny. If you see the cleverness... Hold on. You see the Korach, that he exploited something which was there was a vulnerability, so to speak, in terms of how people relate to the halachic system. He wasn't denying the authority of Moshe Rabbeinu. He couldn't do that. That would be impossible. The entire nation had witnessed Moshe Rabbeinu being called by God to ascend Mount Sinai. And then Moshe came back and delivered the Torah. And the Torah wasn't just the written law, it was the halachic system. But not everything is spelled out that clearly. When you... There was still an area of ambiguity where a person could challenge. A person could accept the Torah Shemalteh, could accept the halachic system, and then he could come to the conclusion that you reach a certain point and that's sufficient. The basic objective is that the halakhic structure should be in line with the purpose. And then you can create scenarios in which you take it even further. These types of questions take it even further where there's a contradiction between the halakhic and between the purpose. So that arena, that area, was one in which you challenged Moshe Rabbeinu. And in fact, that was the purpose one of the objectives of the divine intervention, the miracle, to reaffirm that Moshe Rabbeinu was correct, that not only in terms of the general ideas of the Torah Shabbat, but down to all of these particulars, which is to say that the halachic structure in the world itself, and how the halachic structure is supposed to function, and the manner in which it's going to achieve the objective and the purpose and the time and the area of the relationship, that is not something that man figures out by himself. It's not like you just study the mitzvah, you study the halachic structure, you get a general sense, and now you can apply. Can't do that. You've got to follow the halachic structure down to the very last detail. And even where it would seem to, if there's two choices, for example, of how to go, and one would seem to make sense because this is in line, it's more in line with the top. And the other one is less. But the other one is makes sense halachically. See, there's two ways something can make sense. It can make sense in terms of, yeah, what the whole purpose of the mitzvah is. And a person, you see, if you take a look at the all of the halachic requirements and all of the problems when it comes to any area, sukkah, the types of things that would invalidate a sukkah, the types of things that would invalidate matzah, and the types of structures that wouldn't work or would work, would be successful. In all these cases, a person can say, well, what's the difference? I go into a hut and it reminds me of the experience, and these abstract halachic requirements wouldn't seem to affect you in a practical way. Many of them, maybe even most of them. When you're in the world of the halacha, or matzah, if the matzah had a certain defect and whatever, I mean, is it going to have an effect upon the person? When he eats that matzah, he's even unaware. He wouldn't even be aware of it. And he just looks at matzah, and matzah reminds him of the experience in Egypt, and all these halachic factors, you have whole tractates and people studying it all their lives, don't seem to really have that much bearing upon achieving the objective of the mitzvah. Isn't that true? Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, same thing. That's why the average guy can't understand this. The average guy, what are you laboring over? The Goyim, it's not for the Goyim. Goyim don't have a tithe, everything's just going up. Hey, what's the point? That's an interesting idea. That God gave us the mitzvah. The perfection of the you, in terms of achieving the objective, has to do with, to the greatest extent of his ability, to being involved in the world of halachic perfection. It's a separate arena. As I say, I'm not negating the relationship. That's extremely important. But you cannot forget the relationship between the structure, the halacha of the mitzvah, and the philosophy of the mitzvah. Those two together, that's what constitutes Torah. That's the Torah that God gave us. And every mitzvah is vital, is significant in terms of improving us and bettering us and perfecting us. However, the real perfection is prepared to relate to the mitzvah in its totality, its entirety. And that is that a person has to have a tremendous respect for the mitzvah is an expression of Chachmas Hashem. Simply you can't treat it in a childish kind of a way. And to negate the fact that it contains tremendous wisdom, and it's very, very abstract. Very abstract kind of a system, and it's unlike any other system. The reasoning that's utilized as a person gets into the study of halacha in a deeper way, abstract, you study the approach of chayim, of brisk in approach, you see the abstract concepts which a person could even imagine would be incorporated into the halachic structure, and then you see it's a completely different realm of thought. And this is something that no human being could have devised or would have devised. You don't see, in an ordinary legal system, nobody's involved in this type of thing. They're simply setting up rules and regulations to regulate certain behaviors. And The rules and regulations don't depart that far from the actual purposes. Here, the rules and regulations, so to speak, are a completely different realm. Exquisite halachic structures that, you know, it's a world of knowledge and ideas in and of itself. Which, if when a person studies that, he completely forgets about the purposes. What the whole purpose of the mitzvah is. This is just part of the halakhic system, and the whole objective is to achieve a certain purpose. It becomes, so to speak, a realm of its own. That's what a true Talmudist, a true Talmud Chacham, achieved. That's why. Otherwise, why would... That's our whole history. All of the great people we talk about are people that spent their entire lives immersed in the study of the halakha. All these halakhic questions, all these abstract issues. And it's not just things that are practical halakha or nice. The true area, the greatness of the Gedolim, if you think about their abstract ideas, their chidushim, their interpretation. You see, that's the world that's what halakha lends itself to. The world of halakha is a world of its own. It's like two separate orbits of them. There are two separate orbits. There's an area of the Kama Mitzvah that has to be studied very carefully, and that has to be studied in accordance with the categories that apply to the study of Kama Mitzvah and the study of the halachic makeup of the Mitzvah. And I'm just going to try and show you one illustration that the two do not necessarily always operate in the type of sync that the average individual would imagine it to be. They're connected to each other, but as I said, in a sense, but they're still two separate realms. Let me just show you one case. Hey, the Rambam now in Hilchos Brachos, Perek Gadol, that's chapter 11. It talks about rules and regulations that apply to the different categories of Brachos. And on a lot of basis, he differentiates between different types of mitzvah. The Yesh mitzvah, let's say, there are positive commands, Adam Chayev L'shtadel, Lirdov. The person is obligated to, so to speak, chase after, to do whatever he can do to achieve them. He has an obligation to fulfill them. Atiyata also. That is to say that it's an active involvement. He can't be passive about it. Strive to achieve them. Yom Tzilin, the Sukkah, the Lulav, the Shofar. These are just four examples. The Eilul Hain and the Kiran Chova. These are called Chov, Chova's obligations. The Pisha Adam Chayev al Kopan Masa. The person is obligated, in any case, so to speak, in all situations to do. Now, at this point in time, it's a little bit strange. What do you mean? Every mitzvah would be. The Rambam over here is that. You can see that. The Yesh mitzvah is another kind of a mitzvah. The Eina Chova, which is not obligatory. I'm just reading simplistic translation. Teledom and Rishus. They are similar or akin to voluntary. You have mezuzah. For example, mezuzah. Makah. Makah is the fence that you have to build. If you have in a house with a roof, a flat roof, and people can go up there, so you have to build a fence around it. Ke'ein adam chayev lishkon babayit achayev mezuzah. That a person is not obligated to live in a house that's chayev in mezuzah. Today, you should yask a mezuzah. In order that he should make a mezuzah. Ela, in rata lishkon kol yamav the ohel, if he wants to live his entire life in a tent, or the spina, on a boat, the chayin ain't chayim with no bias to the lack of market. That's an interesting question. If somebody you read the Torah, it is a mitzvah of mezuzah. But a mitzvah of mezuzah, you can't just make a mezuzah and put it in your car. We'll find it in its own right. Really, a lot of people would have there is a phenomenon like that. That people have taken the mezuzah and used it in a non-halachic framework. They may put the mezuzah, there are people that put it, for example, in their car, or they may put it around their neck, or whatever the case may be. And they can even justify it and saying that there's to remind them that there is an important thing. So I can't take it with me. That is a nullification. Here's a case where purely on the level of the time, of the reason, they may have the stronger argument. But in terms of the mitzvah itself, they're acting incorrectly. I don't want to do a thing like that. Now I want to make changes in the mitzvah. That's the whole question, you know, with these Hanukkah menorahs. Well, you know, the Baba just put these huge Hanukkah menorahs, you know. That that's not the mitzvah. So, here, that's a perfect example. Or you could say, well, that's the whole patrician of Manisa, so, you know.
They do it in the park.
What?
They do it in the central park. They have a candle lighting ceremony.
Yeah, but what's there's no mitzvah like that. So this right. There is your basis. There's your own bias and the basic method. But to put up the menorah with Chazal didn't, Chazal didn't maintain that that's the place of the menorah. So you want to have a perfect example. Yeah, but the halachic person says there's no person they need because there's no menorah. That's no person. Another example is the case of the menorah, Hanukkah menorah, where people today it's become very popular. So many people, there's public menorahs in public places, even on the White House lawn, where they're huge. You have to get these cherry pickers to light them. So people can put them in their stores and whatever. And here's a case where people will make an argument that it's publicized. Because the whole idea was to remember the miracle and publicize the miracle. But the question is this appropriate from the halakhic point of view? That is to say, the objective is to publicize, but the mitzvah is merchan. And I'll prove you that you cannot resolve a halachic shayla with regard to the purpose. Specifically in the case of Merchanica. You tell me the machlokas I'm thinking about, I'm just going to get a little coffee. I just thought of there's something in Merchanica which will illustrate the point very clearly. I don't think you guys are aware, but I'm sure we've done this 100 times. With regard to Chanukah, there's a machlokas. The person lit the light, kavsa it's called. He lit the light, and then a wind blew it out. Kavsa zakukwa, kavsa aim zakukwa. That is to say, is he bound to it? Is he connected to it in the sense that if it went out, he has to light it again? He has to relight it? Or no? He doesn't have to relight it. That's the machlokas. Now, how would you approach this machlokas? How do you think the average individual would approach this machlokas? Interesting. From the standpoint of the lawyer, the lawyerly approach to halacha. And here's a case where, generally speaking, those who approach halacha from the loyalty perspective, you know, from the perspective of just fulfilling the objective, they tend to be more lenient. That approach generally is more lenient. And the halachic approach generally tends to be more demanding, because we're concerned with the halachic phenomena per se. However, the loyalty approach would be, yes, related. What did he achieve? The whole purpose is to publicize the miracle. How is the miracle publicized? By the burning of the candle. People see it. So, you lit the candle, it went out, light it again. I'm sure 99% or 100% of people would say that's what you have to do. Yet it's a machlokas, and in point of fact, the actual law is contrary to that. Because what does Allah say? Kasa Aimzaka's law. That if he lit it, and it blew out, he's not bound to it. He does not have to relight it. Now that shock might sound astounding, but what did he achieve? And interestingly, if you follow the logic, then the question would be, so what if I'm lighting it in a windy place? In a place where there's wind. And it blows out. So what's the halakha in that case? Well, having paskin kavsa aimzaka, the average individual would say, fine, so what's the difference? And then, but the halakha will say to him, no. You have this anomaly. That is, if it goes out, you don't have to relight it. But if you lit it in a windy place and it went out, you do have to relight it. What's the reasoning behind this? The explanation can only be found in halachic factors, not in ordinary common sense. Now, in the world of halacha, it's a different question. The question has nothing to do with the fulfillment of the tam. The halachic discussion, the individuals that participate in it, are not thinking about the tam. That's how lawyers approach it. The question over here is, what is the structure of the mitzvah? What is the so-called kiyum ha-mitzvah? The maisa ha-mitzvah, the activity. It's true that the objective is pirsum ha-nisa, but what's my mitzvah? Here's the... The fulfillment of the mitzvah is when you achieve a certain result of a burning light. It's a mitzvah, just a means to have an entity of a burning light. So if you don't have a burning light, you didn't have the mitzvah. These are halachic issues. So we paskin kafas agavah, which is contrary, which is a psak, which is not that much in line with the tam. The other one was more in line with the purpose. But that's halacha. Having said that, however, it turns out that if you light it in a windy place, then you have to relight it. Of course, that the question is why. You just told me that kafas agavah. I don't have to relight it. And once I lift the nair, I fulfill my mitzvah. Ah, well, the answer is, what defines it as a nair chanukah? These are purely halachic questions. What defines it as a chanukah light? Chanukah light is defined as something which can burn, has the capacity to burn. That's why, for example, even though I say if you lit it and it went out after 3 seconds, you fulfilled your mitzvah, but still, the candle has to have the capacity to burn for the requisite amount of time, whether it be a half hour or longer, whatever the case may be. Why? Because now we're talking about what is halachically defined as a Hanukkah light, as an air Hanukkah. So therefore, it has to have the requisite capability of burning for the full time. And if it went out by accident, then you fulfill your mitzvah, because your mitzvah was to light a Hanukkah light. At the time that you did it, it was a Hanukkah light. Some accident came along and put it out. But you fulfilled your mitzvah already. However, if it's lacking in the amount of oil that's necessary, or if it's in a place where, due to the circumstances of the place, it can't burn, so then this can't be defined as an air chanukah. So that's a halachic decision. Halacha has decided that you didn't fulfill your mitzvah, but all these issues are being decided and debated along purely halachic criteria, not in terms of a lawyer trying to figure out how we can fulfill the purpose of the mitzvah. I think this is a great illustration, is all right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so in the case that I started first, all right, so we get that down. Now, getting to the Rambam, in terms of what he seems to be categorizing as obligatory mitzvot, as opposed to mitzvot which are not korva and are close to reshut, he's saying that the mitzvah of mezuzah basically is close to being an optional mitzvah. And in a sense, one could even view it as optional, but you have your choice. All things being equal, you have no choice with regard to tefillin, or with regard to sukkah. It's an inherent obligation. Tefillin is not conditional. There's no condition. As soon as you reach the age of 13, the obligation devolves upon you. And the same is true with the others that he cited. Shofar, of course, shofar is contingent upon time, but that doesn't matter. That's an accident. That's the time of Rosh Hashanah, the chiyuv of shofar. So there's no choice involved in terms of the individual. However, when it comes to the other mitzvahs that he's mentioned, for example, market. So I think you say, well, the Torah commands us to make a market, to make a fence around the roof. So, what if I don't have a roof? What if I don't have a house? Well, here you can have a house. Mezuzah is contingent upon a house. With maka, you can have a house, but it doesn't have a roof that would require a maka. Not every roof requires maka. It would have to be a roof which is accessible, which people can go on. Like you have these sloped roofs today, but nobody walks on these roofs, so it doesn't require a maka. If you have a flat roof, which pretty much we don't have today. So then, the question arises, am I obligated to buy a house? But again, common sense person might even come along and think like that. But the Rambam is saying that the halacha is that you don't have to have mezuzah inherently. You're not inherently connected to mezuzah because it depends upon living in a certain situation. That's the entity of mezuzah. That's why the whole idea of having a mezuzah elsewhere, a person wants to be from, and put up a mezuzah and a tent, or put it up in a car, put it elsewhere because he wants to be more zealous. This is, again, where the average person might think, but the average person thinks in simplistic terms, not halachic terms. This is a good thing, that's an avera, it's a sin. It's a very serious avera. To distort, you know how to add to the mitzvah, you know how to detract, and that means you can't negate, you can't change, you can't distort. Person does not have a house, does not do the mitzvah of mezuzah. Then not only doesn't do it, but it's not a mezuzah. Because the mezuzah is defined as being a mezuzah. Only in relationship to the house, you put on the doorpost, it's connected to the house. Outside of that, there is no mezuzah. So now, a person might get the sense from this that because this is the case, that there are certain mitzvahs that are more important than others. The average person reading this would say, okay, so the first category of mitzvahs are very important. The second category are probably less important. With regard to ma'akeh, he may have a case. And that is to say, because it doesn't seem on the surface that the mitzvah of ma'akeh is something which is a positive phenomenon in and of itself, that one should strive for the mitzvah of ma'akeh in and of itself. Because by its very nature, the whole point of the ma'akeh is to prevent an accident from happening. Well, something done in Zeisefa. You should not be responsible for bloodshed in your own house. By the way, it extends itself to more than just the market. That's the classic illustration. But any situation of danger, you have staircases which are dangerous, you have an upstairs level and you have a gate, a person can fall off. There's other situations where situations of danger in your own house. That's incorporated. Well, it's not done as they said. You shouldn't be responsible for bloodshed in your own house. You're not allowed to allow dangerous situations to go unattended in your own house. If that's the case, so then a person might say, okay, if I mock it, I fully understand that. I think the average individual would understand that the mitzvah of maka is a precaution. And given that you have a certain possibility of danger, so no one's going to argue that you're obligated to create the foundation of that situation of danger, to produce a house with a flat roof, in order so that you fulfill the mitzvah of the fence, where the whole objective is precautionary, and to avoid danger. Then I think people would argue, and thus they would say, okay, I understand that. The mitzvah only comes into being when you have a situation like that. Now, a person might extend the same reasoning to mezuzah. We sort of downgrade the importance of mezuzah because it's something that essentially a person has choice here. He chooses, and the same, by the way, would be true about tzitzis. The tzitzis is dependent on a garment, and the garment is defined as a four-cornered garment. So we don't even wear four-cornered garments anymore. So that's a mitzvah that a person could avoid. My simple way, even when they did have four-cornered garments, if a person wanted to avoid it, he could avoid those kinds of garments. There, too, a person might diminish the significance of the mitzvah. However, let's turn now to what the Rambam says about mitzvah and Hilchos mitzvah. Perek Zion, excuse me, Perek Vav, at the end of the sixth chapter, the final halacha in that section that deals with mitzvah. In the next chapter, we go on to take a seller. The Rambam says, Chayev Adam Yizayev Mezuzah. A person is obligated to be very careful about the
Mezuzah. Which one?
Mezuzah Yizayev Mezuzah. because it is the obligation of everyone constantly. Because of my seat, Tanay, and every time that he enters me, he puts a Yisrael Hashem. He counters the idea of the unity of God. This is translated, the Yisrael Hashem, the unity of God. Shemo Yisrael HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the name of God. The Yisrael Ahavasa, and he remembers the love of God. The Yeor Meshigato, and he awakens from his sleep. The Shigyoto, and in fantasy, the Havayatman, and the vanities of the time. He gave that, and he knows, to Ein Davar Ha'omei Li'olam, that there is nothing which endures eternally. Li'olmei Olam, Ela Yiziyat Nur Ha'olam, except for the knowledge of the Rock of the World. And this is an amazing explanation, something that is extremely significant in its own right, because, you know, this is the kind of mystery that there's a tremendous amount of misunderstanding, or people ascribe power to them. So people are careful. People in general, religious people are not here. I was concerned about the religion, but not for the reasons that the Rambam has cited. That's become the thing of being, there's a certain element of exploitation of people's fears. There's a certain suspicious element. It's current among certain people today. That the mezuzah has the power to protect the house, and that the person protects the mezuzah if bad things are happening to him. That's a falsification, dangerous line of thinking. There's a lot of that pertain to the checking of the mezuzah. Twice in 7 years, the person has to have a mezuzah checked. The Rambam's explanation, however, of the great importance of the mezuzah is different. This is something that a person can understand. It's rooted in the very Tom, the real Tom of the mezuzah, is to serve as a reminder of certain fundamental ideas that are vital in the day-to-day life of the individual. The day-to-day life of the individual is that he gets caught up in the vanity of the time, and there's no way to avoid it. To the extent that a person is involved, that's right, that's a reality, and there's nothing wrong with that. Once a person gets involved in business, profession, all the different tasks, so that's the way we are. You get this, you do a significant job, you get involved, your emotions are involved, and you balance, the whole picture is distorted because it begins to attribute to vanity the character of reality. And the amount of energy that he, the aggravation, the anxiety, and so forth, it begins to treat the temporal as though it was forever, and that's the biggest distorting point. He has to have his, always should have his sight on the ultimate reality. The ultimate reality, that which endures, is not this physical arena that we become involved in. We can't negate it, we need it, we have to utilize it, but it's the idea of the real love, and that's the whole purpose. And that really is the real foundation of the bias. When you walk into the house, that's what you should just recognize and remember. And that has a sobering effect on the person. To bring him back into the world of reality. That's what he says, as soon as he stops and he pauses and contemplates the ideas of the mezuzah, which nobody does, because now they're things you're kissing them. So once you have this rote action, it becomes a rote phenomenon. You walk in, you walk out, kissing the mezuzah now becomes the end of the song. The person didn't kiss the mezuzah, he's not a firm person, not a good person. But that's not what the Rambam is even mentioning. That the Rambam mentions that he relates to the idea of the mezuzah, and he says, it's a wake-up call. He immediately sent him. And now he walks in straight path. Because the reason why a person walks in the wrong path is because it's consumed with the incorrect notion of what's ultimate. The person always has that this is the ultimate thing. And once he gets caught up in the internalization of that which is temporal, fantasy world, well, that's it. He keeps walking down the crooked path. But the realization of the fundamental truth, that this is nothing, to keep it as vanities of the time, the means to an end, and the real objective is to see us through all of them, the knowledge of the back of the world, that's what endures, that's what's eternal, and then it's all focused and shifted. Then you walk straight there. And then he quotes a very important chazal, Amru Chazal Marishanim. Chazal says, Kol mi sheyesh lo tefillin berosho ro'o, whoever has tefillin on his head and on his hand, his arm, the tzitzis of zigdo, and tzitzis of garment, the mezuzah of the tzitzah, and the mezuzah on his doorpost, looks like those, he's assured, he has an assurance, shelo yechta, that he won't sin. Sha'arei yesh lo maskire zavu, but he has many reminders. Shehein heim amalotin, shematilin otel milasta. These are the angels that save him from sin. So with regard to the question as to whether the mezuzah is a protection, people look at it as a protection. Yes, of course it's a protection. But not in the way that they imagine it. It's the angel. Well, the angels are instruments, mitzvahs, that have been designed by God to cause a person never to go too far, never to drift away from the central ideas. That the angel of God encamps around those who fear him and sustains them. That's the idea, profound ideas attached to the mitzvahs. And there's a connection between these three, because these three are connected to the most significant elements of the person in terms of being a physical being. It still relates to the body itself, and the sickness relates to the garments, the clothing of a person. It's the second degree of the physical protection, and the third degree of protection is the house. And the point has been made, you see, with regard to Haraz, for example, God sends an affliction to remind a person, it hits him in these three arenas. The last of the Torah relates, called leprosy, the a natural phenomenon. The divine punishment for the sin of evil speech, Losh and Hara. That it afflicts the house and the garments and finally the body of the person. It corresponds to what the Rambam has said over here. This is very close to a person. But his whole sense of identity is tied very much with his body, physical appearance, that's his image, and along with that image, how he dresses himself up, his clothing, and of course the kind of house he lives in. These three things are the main elements of a person's image and support them. So if he's trying to create an identity based upon the individual not being a ceremony to him, that the divine soul is the essence, but all of the extraneous, the physical, the aesthetic aspect. So that's why in these three areas, the Torah placed signs reminding that that's not the real objective, that's not the real purpose. The real purpose is to utilize these things for the service of Hashem. That's what it's worth. So, after reading this, you have a completely different picture. Turns out that the mitzvah of mezuzah and tefillin, two out of these three, the mitzvah tefillin is in the category of mitzvah that the Rambam and Hilchos Brachos categorize as being chov, obligatory. And that's very important. So, in this formulation, he puts all those three together. In the formulation of the significance of the mitzvah, that a person should be very, very scrupulous about it, he's talking about mezuzah, and he includes tefillin and tzitzis, and then he quotes chazal that puts all these three together in that realm. So in the realm of what we would call the tana mitzvah, these three go together. It's of tremendous importance. And he hasn't differentiated one from the other. However, when it comes to the categorization in Hilchos Brachos, he separates tefillin from the other two. The tefillin is chov. Mezuzah, he puts in the category of things which are close to being reshus. And the average person would get the impression that it's not that as important. And in fact, he may say he put it in the same category as Maka. But you see from here that you can't put it in the same category as Maka. Maka, one could argue, that there is no real purpose, so to speak. A person can go out of his way, philosophically speaking, a person can go out of his way to have a house so he can do the mark. But the mark itself, essentially, is the removal of a danger. But, with regard to the mezuzah, from a purely halachic standpoint, in terms of the structure of the mitzvah, it's in a category with makkah. But you can't make any deduction from that in terms of its importance. The Rambam in mezuzah says that it's kol bas kol tamid, it's an enduring obligation, that he extols it, how significant, how important. Therefore, if a person simply studied mezuzah, didn't study hilchos brachos, and came to the conclusion, well, if that's the case, what kind of mitzvah? Is it obligatory, inherently obligatory? The person said, of course it is. Look how important it is. You see that he has two different worlds. The realm of the Tam HaMitzvah is one realm, but in terms of the structure of the mitzvah, the halachic structure of the mitzvah, which incorporates the idea of the chiyav, how the chiyav, how your obligation is to be devolved upon the person, and so on and so forth. As far as that's concerned, that's a separate realm, and in that realm, it's put into the category of those mitzvahs that a person is not obligated to persevere, to strive, l'shtadel, to do it. It's rather in the category of mitzvahs that are conditional, contingent, if he's in this situation. And if he chooses not to be in that situation, he's free of the obligation. You can't make any deduction from the Tam HaMitzvah from the as to the halachic structure of the mitzvah. It's two different worlds. Alright, it's eight. That's the point that I wanted to illustrate. That the perfected individual in terms of Torah has to know how to direct himself. He's got to study all the different areas of the Torah. He's got to be completely dedicated to studying the time of it. So there's no question about it. The benefits of the mitzvah, the perfection, the philosophy. But equally has to recognize the nature of the halachic system. Has to recognize the nature, for starters, that it's a completely different realm that operates according to its own rules. And that goes all the way back to Sinai. There's no difference between the authority of the halachic factors as well as the Torah of the Chav, as well as the philosophy of that. Every aspect of the mitzvah goes back to Sinai, and everything has to be, if you want to fulfill the Torah, you have to fulfill it purely in accordance with the directions that God has given. Any movement that seeks to have a different approach, and of course all the other religions and all within Judaism, are trying to take certain aspects of the Torah and to negate, basically the attack against Judaism has to do with the negating of the Mitzvah. That's the vulnerability. That's the area of vulnerability. It always has been the area of vulnerability because it's something that doesn't fit into human categories. It's not popular because the other thing, do you take the Torah of Mitzvah? It fits in into the human category. To return a lost object, and my father and mother, yeah, that people can relate to that. There's much in the Torah that people can relate to. But the arena of the halacha, that's something that the people, not only they can't relate to, but they resist it and they rebel against it. And that's a separate area, it's a tremendous perfection, but that is Torah. And the perfection of Torah, the perfection of the individual in Torah has to do with both areas, of course, to the extent that it's possible. But at least, even if a person does not have the ability to become a Talmudic scholar, it doesn't matter. This basic knowledge that we've discussed today, this basic awareness, this basic recognition that the world of halacha is a world of its own, a world of profound wisdom in and of itself, which whose wisdom does not always or necessarily reflect the philosophical purposes of the mitzvah. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but it doesn't have to. It's a separate world. It's a separate world of knowledge, it's a separate world of ideas. That's something that is vitally important for everybody to recognize that. And that's, if you don't recognize that, you can't recognize the Chachmei Yisrael. And you can't recognize the Gedolim of the Masorah, the whole system of Torah. That is an element of the story of the rebellion of Torah. That
we could understand why it was necessary for the miracle, for his divine intervention. It wasn't just another machlok. But it was an argument that if it were not to be resolved, would have picked away at the whole system. We destroyed the whole halachic system, and you cannot have Judaism without the halachic system as it was revealed by God to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu and revealed it to the next day, and that's the whole system of the Masorah. And we can only fulfill the Torah through the system of the Masorah that God has given to us. Okay, that's it.
Perfection of the halachic system on its own would be just to have an appreciation of the ideas that the abstract ideas of the system itself. To see it.
That's part of it. That's part of it. I'm not saying how the two fit together. I didn't go into the why. Why it is this way and how one leads to the other. And there's no doubt that a person has a profounder appreciation of the Talmud that's supposed to be the halachi. I'm not denying all that. I didn't go further than what I just said. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, I just made this first step.
Okay.
Look, all the Chachma in Judaism is appreciation of Chachma Hashem. There's no question about it. This is Chachma Hashem. So, honestly, I didn't go further than what I said. Let's just leave for that. Write down your questions. We can come back and perhaps go further on this. You understand?
Yeah.
This is all I'm prepared to say at the moment. I mean, let's just digest this.
Okay.
All right, take care, guys. Have a good time.
Right there.
Yeah. Idea. I see, that's a good point you're making. What we just said negates a false idea that people have when they encounter famous arguments. For example, the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. That is, many people think that the differences, great halachic differences, have to do with the personalities of the individual, or that they have to do with the philosophies of the individual. This is a degradation of Chachma HaTorah. And it's what's referred to as Matrish Mahidel. But the Rambam says one of the categories of people who lose their share in the world to come are those who negate the personal qualities of the Balei HaTorah, of the great masters of the oral law. Why? Do you see how significant this is? That's a negation of Torah. Anyone who going to maintain that they can explain an argument among great gadolim, whether of our generation or past generations, with reference to what their philosophies were, their social ideals were, or so forth, that whole approach is going back to Torah. That is the rebellion of Torah. It's a negation of the fact that the arguments of the great Balayam authorities were masters, these were people who were imbued with the knowledge to study all the principles of the halachic system, the methods, the methodologies, the mechanisms, and were engaged in the quote-unquote, the scientific, so to speak. That type of a thing. Purely engaged in a search for the halachic truth, and the conclusions that they arrived at were based upon their understanding of the halacha. The halacha was given over to the human mind, and there'll be differences in opinions. That's why you have a Sanhedrin on Sanhedrin's day, but the Sanhedrin has its method of resolving disputes and establishing the halacha. The objective is there should be one halacha for everybody. Unfortunately, we can't do that today. But these are differences that stem from their understanding of the phenomena itself, in the same way that you may have an argument among great scientists. Pure science, a pure scientist, is one who arrives at a certain conclusion not because he has a certain aim in mind, a certain policy in mind, but purely because of his understanding. After an honest, completely honest review of all the phenomena, this is his understanding of the phenomena. A different mind. Another scientific mind will come to a different conclusion. But if it's truthful, they are both genuine scientific conclusions, and you can't explain one or the other based upon what his political philosophy is. If you could explain that this scientist took this position because his political philosophy was such that he wanted to bring about some kind of a peace and so on and so forth, then that person is a phony scientist. It means to say he wasn't searching for the scientific truth. Just like a judge on the Supreme Court. If he came to a certain conclusion, not because he's convinced that this is what the Constitution says, but simply because he wants his results because it fits in with his social agenda, then he's a phony judge. He's a corrupt judge. He's corrupt as a judge. He's not functioning as a judge. Thus, those who maintain that they can explain the argument of great Talmudic masters and their conclusions, because superficially that's the way it appears to them. It's basically all it reveals is the fact that they can't appreciate halachic phenomena, they don't understand it, and all they can see is the goal, the end result, and they're sort of projecting their own inadequacies onto these people. Cannot be done. That is, again, going back, harkening back to what Korach was trying to do. He was laughing at Moshe Rabbeinu, denying that there's any validity to the halachic system in this area. That is the situation over here, that if a person wants to understand an argument between great rabbis, you have to have recourse to their halachic reasoning, and you have to explain it in terms of the halachic reasoning. But those who seek to explain it in terms of what society is coming from and what he wants to achieve and his objectives, that's a falsification. Okay, guys.
All right.
That's it. Good job.
All right. Thank you.
Like a scientific approach. But nothing outside, nothing extraneous. You can't explain the theory of relativity extraneous to science and say, well, there are reasons why he had ulterior motives in coming up with that idea. It's a purely natural result of his scientific thinking. So I don't know why, if you use the word philosophy, you're confusing. So too, the spatial conclusion was purely a result of his halachic reasoning. That's how he reasoned halachically. Nothing outside of it. Not a desire in the case with the gear to be harsh or this or whatever it is. Not a desire for nothing outside of that. That's how his halachic reasoning, that's what it leads to. Okay? All right, guys. All right, we'll talk about as you need to. Let me pick it up. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, guys. That's
all
it.
All right, thanks a lot.
Tape is over. The tape machine is over.
And that is that if these brachas are the Araisa,
So then what, and they were, the Dakota, the Texans, that's what they did until a certain point in history, so then what did they do beforehand? Now we found the solution. Rush Bar is giving the suggestion that you can't say they didn't say it, apparently, because it's part of the right. On the other hand, you didn't have the Dakota. Oh, so now it was we've established from the Yom Raya that there's a concept of doing something like the right, which is a general idea, and a person can express it in his own words, and he chose that. So we'll take that idea now. And we'll say that the 40 years before Yeshua was attacking Birkas Haaretz, they did have a huge Birkas Haaretz. So they said it without a formal text. They get along with formalized. And as far as Binyan Yerushalayim, and that concerns,